sense of integrity. Working with the morning pages, we begin to sort through the differences between our real feelings, which are often secret, and our official feelings, those on record for public display. Official feelings are often indicated by the phrase, "I feel okay about that." At the root of a successful creative recovery is the commitment to puncture our denial, to stop saying, "It's okay," when in fact it's something else, something specific. Many tend to neglect or abandon the pages whenever an unpleasant piece of clarity is about to emerge. Just as an athlete accustomed to running becomes irritable when he's unable to get his miles in, so too, those of us accustomed now to morning pages will notice an irritability when we let them slide. But we are tempted always to reverse cause and effect. "I was too crabby to write them," we say, instead of, "I didn't write them, so I'm crabby." Over any considerable period of time, the morning pages perform spiritual chiropractic. That is, they realign our values. If we are to the left or the right of our personal truth, the pages will point out the need for a course adjustment. Chekhov advised, "If you want to work on your art, work on your life." That's another way of saying that in order to have self-expression, we must first have a self to express. The process of identifying a self inevitably involves loss as well as gain. We discover our boundaries, and those boundaries by definition separate us from our fellows. As we clarify our perceptions, we lose our misconceptions. As we eliminate ambiguity, well, we lose illusion as well. We arrive at clarity, and clarity creates change. "I've outgrown this job," may appear in the morning pages. At first, it's a troubling perception. Over time, it becomes a call for action, and then an action plan. But in addition to posing problems, the pages may also pose solutions. "I am bored with me." It'd be fun to learn French. As we notice which friends bore us, which situations leave us stifled, we are often rocked by waves of sorrow. Faced with impending change, change we've set in motion with our own hand, we want to mutiny. "I don't want to raise my consciousness," we wail. "I want..." And thanks to the morning pages, we learn what we want, and, ultimately, become willing to make the changes needed to get it, but not without a tantrum, and not without a kriya, a Sanskrit word meaning spiritual emergency or surrender. We all know what a kriya looks like. It's the bad case of the flu right after you've broken up with your lover. It's the rotten head cold and bronchial cough that announces that you've abused your health to meet an unreachable work deadline. In 12-step groups, kriyas are often called surrenders. People are told, just let go. And they would if they knew what they were holding on to. With the morning pages in place and the artist dates in motion, the radio stands half a chance of picking up the message you are sending and or receiving. Morning pages point the way to reality. This is how you're really feeling. What do you make of that? And what we make of that is often art. As we lose our vagueness about self, our values, our life situation, we become available to the moment. It is there, in the particular, that we contact the creative self. Until we experience the freedom of this solitude, we cannot connect authentically. We may be enmeshed, but we are not encountered. Art lies in the moment of encounter. We meet our truth and we meet ourselves. We meet ourselves and our self-expression. We become original because we become something specific, an origin from which work flows. Remember that the more you feel yourself to be terra incognita, the more certain you can be that the recovery process is working. One of the clearest signals that something healthy is afoot is the impulse to weed out, sort through, and discard old clothes, papers, and belongings. By tossing out the old and unworkable, we make way for the new and the suitable. When we have engaged the Creator within to heal us, many changes and many shifts in our attitudes begin to occur. I'll enumerate some of them here, because many of these will not be recognizable at first as healing. There will be a change in your energy patterns. You will find yourself remembering your nighttime dreams, and by day, daydreams will catch your attention. Many areas of your life that previously seemed to fit will stop fitting. For example, your musical bent may alter. Your sense of color may shift. In short, in all areas, your tastes and judgments and personal identity will begin to show through. You may even find your own candor unsettling. Conditioned as we are to accept other people's definitions of us, this emerging individuality can seem to us like self-will run riot. It's not. You may well be experiencing a sense of both bafflement and faith. You're no longer stuck, but you cannot tell where you're going. It's normal to yearn for some rest when you're moving so rapidly. What you will learn to do is rest in motion, like lying down in a boat. Your morning pages are your boat. They will both lead you forward and give you a place to recuperate from your forward motion. There is a special power in writing out the deal we are making. The phrase, "I receive your good willingly," written out each morning, reminds us to be open to increased good during the day. "I trust my own perceptions" is another powerful affirmation to use in writing or simply in speech as we undergo shifts in identity. As recovering creatives, we often have to excavate our own pasts for the shards of buried dreams and delights. And so, we will approach certain problems from many different angles, all of them aimed at eliciting more information from your unconscious about what you might consciously enjoy. Now, we're going to go through a quick list. Answer quickly. Fill in the blanks. 5 hobbies that sound fun. 5 classes that sound fun. 5 things you personally would never do that sound fun. 5 skills that would be fun to have. 5 things you used to enjoy doing. 5 things you'd like to try once. Remember, with a list like this, it is always possible to go back and fill it in more completely. The questions are intended to be like bolts of lightning, illuminating an area and then allowing it to fade back. Now let's take a look at a controversial and potent artist way tool. Probably the most controversial tool. I call it reading deprivation. If you feel stuck in your life or in your art, few jump starts are more effective than a week of reading deprivation. No reading. That's right, no reading. For most artists, words are like tiny tranquilizers. We have a daily quota of media chat that we swallow up. Like greasy food, it clogs our system. Too much of it and we feel, yes, fried. It's a paradox that by emptying our lives of distractions, we are actually filling the well. Reading deprivation casts us into our inner silence, a space some of us begin to immediately fill with new words, long gossipy conversations, television binging, the radio as a constant chatty companion. We often cannot hear our own inner voice, the voice of our artist's inspiration above the static. In practicing reading deprivation, we need to cast a watchful eye on all these other pollutants. They poison the well. If we monitor the inflow, we will be rewarded for our reading deprivation with embarrassing speed. Our reward will be a new outflow. Our own art, our own thoughts and feelings will begin to nudge aside the sludge of blockage, to loosen it and move it upward and outward until once again our well is running freely. Reading deprivation is a very powerful tool, and a frightening one. In my teaching, the week that I assign reading deprivation is always a tough one. I go to the podium knowing that I will be the enemy. At least one student always explains to me, pointedly, in no uncertain terms, that he or she is a very important and busy person with duties and obligations that include reading. I ask my class to turn their creativity to wriggling into not reading. But what will we do? Comes next. Here's a brief list. Listen to music, knit, work out, make curtains, cook, meditate, wash the dog, fix the bike, have friends to dinner, sort closets, watercolor, pay bills, rewire the lamp, get the stereo working, write old friends, paint the bedroom, sort bookshelves, that one's dangerous, repot some plants, rearrange the kitchen, go dancing, mend. The nasty bottom line is this. Sooner or later, if you are not reading, you will run out of work and be forced to play. You'll light some incense or put on an old jazz record or paint a shelf turquoise, and then you will feel not just better, but actually a little excited. Don't read. If you can't think of anything else to do, cha-cha. That's it for week 4. Now let's do our expansion tasks. Number 1, environment. Describe your ideal environment. Number 2, time travel. Describe yourself at 80. Number 3, environment. Look at your house. Is there any room that you could make into a secret private space for yourself? This is your dream area. Even a bookshelf or a corner under a staircase would do. Number 4, write your own artist's prayer. Number 5, open your closet. Throw out or hand on or donate one low self-worth outfit to the universe. Week 5. Recovering a sense of possibility. One of the chief barriers to accepting God's generosity is our limited notion of what we are in fact able to accomplish. So this is a chapter about limits. Remembering that God is my source, we're in the spiritual position of having an unlimited bank account. Most of us never consider how powerful the Creator really is. Instead, we draw very limited amounts of the power available to us. We decide how powerful God is for us. We unconsciously set a limit on how much God can give us or help us. Some of you may be thinking that this sounds like the magic wand chapter. I pray and presto. Sometimes that is how it'll feel. More often, what we are talking about seems to be a conscious partnership in which we work along slowly and gradually, clearing away the wreckage of our negative patterning, clarifying the vision of what it is we want, learning to accept small pieces of that vision from whatever source, and then, one day, presto, the vision seems to suddenly be in place. In other words, pray to catch the bus, then run as fast as you can. For this to happen, first of all, we must believe that we are allowed to catch the bus. If we learn to think of receiving God's good as being an act of worship, cooperating with God's plan to manifest goodness in our lives, we can begin to let go of having to sabotage ourselves. One reason we are miserly with ourselves is scarcity thinking. We don't want our luck to run out. We don't want to overspend our spiritual abundance. Again, we are limiting our flow by anthropomorphizing God into a capricious parent figure. Remembering that God is our source, an energy flow that likes to extend itself, we become more able to tap our creative power effectively. Creativity is a spiritual issue. Any progress is made by leaps of faith, some small and some large. As each idea comes to us, we must in good faith clear away our inner barriers to acting on it, and then on an outer level, take the concrete steps necessary to trigger our synchronous good. If this sounds airy-fairy to you, ask yourself bluntly, what next step are you evading? God as my source is a simple but completely effective plan for living. It removes negative dependency and anxiety from our lives by assuring us that God will provide. Our job is to listen for how. One way we listen is by writing our morning pages. But experiment with this two-step process. Ask for answers in the evening. Listen for answers in the morning. Be open to all help. There is a river of help. Let's talk about finding the river. The shift to spiritual dependency is a gradual one. We've been making this shift slowly and surely. With each day, we become more true to ourselves, more open to the positive. To our surprise, this seems to be working in our human relationships. We find we are able to tell more of our truth, hear more of other people's truth. The morning pages, a flow of stream of consciousness, gradually loosens our hold on fixed opinions and short-sighted views. We see that our moods, views, and insights are transitory. We acquire a sense of movement, a current of change in our lives. This current, or river, is the flow of grace moving us to our right livelihood, companions, destiny. Dependence on the Creator within is really freedom from all other dependencies. Paradoxically, it is also the only route to real intimacy with other human beings. We are able to live with more spontaneity. Freed from our constant demands for more and more reassurance, our fellows are able to love us back without feeling so burdened. As we've listened to our artist child within, it has begun to feel more and more safe. Feeling safe, it speaks a little louder. This newly positive attitude is the beginning of trust. We are learning to give up idolatry, the worshipful dependency on any person, place, or thing. Instead, we place our dependency on the source itself. The source meets our needs through people, places, and things. Time and again, I have seen a recovering creative do the footwork of becoming internally clear and focused about dreams and delights, take a few outward steps in the direction of the dream, only to have the universe fling open an unsuspected door. One of the central tasks of creative recovery is learning to accept this generosity. This can be difficult for some of us if we're caught in the virtue trap. An artist must have downtime. Time to do nothing. Defending our right to such time takes courage, conviction, and resiliency. For an artist, withdrawal is necessary. Without it, our artist child feels vexed, angry, and out of sorts. If such deprivation continues, our artist child becomes sullen, depressed, hostile. We eventually become like cornered animals snarling at our family and friends to leave us alone and stop making unreasonable demands. We are the ones making unreasonable demands. We expect our artist to be able to function without giving it what it needs to do so. An artist requires the upkeep of creative solitude. Without this period of recharging, our artist becomes depleted. We're caught in the virtue trap. Many recovering creatives sabotage themselves most frequently by making nice. There is a tremendous cost to such ersatz virtue. Afraid to appear selfish, we lose ourself. We become self-destructive. Because this self-murder is something we seek passively rather than consciously act out, we are often blind to its poisonous grip on us. The question, "Are you self-destructive?" is asked so frequently that we seldom hear it accurately. What it means is, are you destructive of yourself? And what that really asks us is, are you destructive of your true nature? Many people caught in the virtue trap do not appear to be self-destructive to the casual eye. Bent on being good husbands, fathers, mothers, wives, teachers, whatevers. They have constructed a false self that looks good to the world and meets with a lot of worldly approval. This false self is always patient, always willing to defer its needs to meet the needs or demands of another. What a great guy. That Fred gave up his concert tickets to help me move on Friday night. Are you self-destructive is a question that the apparently virtuous would answer with a resounding no. They then conjure up a list proving how responsible they are. But responsible to whom? The question is, are you self-destructive? Not, do you appear self-destructive? Are you self-destructive? This is a very difficult question to answer. To begin with, it requires that we know something of our true self, and that's the very self we're systematically destroying. One quick way to ascertain the degree of drift is to ask yourself this question. What would I try if it weren't too crazy? Skydiving? Scuba diving? Belly dancing? Latin dancing? Getting my poems published? Buying a drum set? Bicycling through France? If your list looks pretty exciting, even if crazy, then you're on the right track. Ask next, what would I do if it weren't too selfish? Sign up for scuba lessons. Take the Latin dancing class at the Y. Buy the Poets Market and make a submission a week. Get the used drum set my cousin's trying to sell. Call my travel agent and check out tickets to France. By seeking the Creator within and embracing our own gift of creativity, we learn to be spiritual in this world. In this way, we avoid the virtue trap. Now let's take a look at forbidden joys, because one of the favored tricks of blocked creatives is saying no to ourselves. List to yourself 10 things you love and would love to do, but don't allow yourself to. Go dancing, carry a sketchbook, roller skate, buy new cowboy boots, streak your hair blonde, go on vacation, take flying lessons, move to a bigger place, direct a play, take life drawing class. Very often, the mere act of writing out your list of forbidden joys breaks down your barriers to doing them. This is because one of the best ways we can evade our censor is to use the technique of speed writing or quick association. We're going to work with another list, a wish list. Because wishes are just wishes, they are allowed to be frivolous and frequently should be taken very seriously. As quickly as you can, free associate on the following phrase. I wish. I most especially wish. That's it for week 5. Now let's look at our tasks. Number 1. The reason I can't really believe in a supportive God is, list 5 grievances you hold against God. Number 2. Start an image file. List 5 desires. Be alert for images of those desires. Collect them in a folder. Number 3. If I were 20 and had money, list 5 adventures you would take. Number 4. If I were 65 and had money, list 5 postponed pleasures, adventures you would then take. Number 5. List 10 items you would like to own, but you don't. Week 6. Creating a sense of abundance. For many of us, raised to believe that money is the real source of security, a dependence on God feels foolhardy, suicidal, even laughable. When we consider the lilies of the field, we think they're quaint and too out of it for the modern world. We're the ones who keep clothes on our backs. We're the ones who buy the groceries. And we will pursue our art, we tell ourselves, when we have enough money to do it easily. A museum tour of Europe? Dance classes? God's not about to spring for those, we tell ourselves. We cling to our financial concerns as a way to avoid not only our art, but also our spiritual growth. Our faith is in the dollar. I have to keep a roof over my head, we say. Nobody's going to pay me to be more creative. We're awfully sure about that. Most of us harbor a secret belief that work has to be work and not play, and that anything we really want to do, like write, act, dance, must be considered frivolous and be placed a distant second. This is not true. We are operating out of the toxic old idea that God's will for us and our will for us are at opposite ends of the table. I want to be an actress, but God wants me to wait tables in hash joints. Thinking like this is grounded in the idea that God is a stern parent. Many of us equate difficulty with virtue, as we've said, and we equate art with fooling around. On the one hand, we give lip service to the notion that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. On the other, we secretly think that God wants us to be broke if we're going to be so decadent as to want to be artists. Do we have any proof at all for these ideas about God? Looking at God's creation, it's pretty clear that the Creator itself did not know when to stop. There is not one pink flower, or even 50 pink flowers, but hundreds, thousands. Snowflakes, of course, are the ultimate exercise in sheer creative glee. No two alike. This Creator looks suspiciously like someone who might send us support for our creative ventures. We act like it's God's fault we don't go to Europe, take that painting class, go on that photo shoot. In truth, we, not God, have decided not to go. This is extravagant, but so is God, is a good attitude to take when treating your artist to small bribes and beauties. Remember, you're the cheapskate, not God. What we really want to do is what we are really meant to do. When we do what we are meant to do, money comes to us, doors open for us, we feel useful, and the work we do feels like play to us. This brings us to a related notion, luxury. All too often we become blocked and blame it on our lack of money. This is never an authentic block. The actual block is our feeling of constriction, our sense of powerlessness. We play this out by making inappropriate choices in our use of money. Art requires us to empower ourselves with choice. At the most basic level, this means choosing to do self-care. In order to thrive as artists, and one could argue as people, we need to be available to the universal flow. When we put a stopper on our capacity for joy by anorectically declining the small gifts of life, we turn aside the larger gifts as well. What gives us true joy? That's the question to ask concerning luxury, and for each of us the answer's very different. For Bernice, the answer's raspberries, fresh raspberries. For Alan, music is the great luxury. A musician when he was younger, he had long denied himself the right to play. Working on his creative recovery, Alan began by allowing himself the luxury of buying one new recording a week. He stopped making music work and started making it fun again. Luxury is a transition into expansion, but it begins with baby steps. For Laura, a dime store set of watercolor paints was her first foray into luxury. For Kathy, it was a deluxe Crayola set, the kind my mother would never get me. But for many blocked creatives, it takes a little work to even imagine ourselves having a luxury. Luxury is a learned practice for most of us. This is what we need to remember. What we are talking about when we discuss luxury is very often a shift in consciousness more than flow. As we acknowledge and invite what feels luxurious to us, we trigger an increased flow. Creative living requires another luxury, the luxury of time, which we must carve out for ourselves, even if it's 15 minutes for quick morning pages and 10 minutes for a mini bath after work. Creative living also requires the luxury of space for ourselves, even if all we manage to carve out is one special bookshelf and a windowsill that's ours. Designating a few things special and yours alone can go a long way toward making you feel pampered. Chinatown Anywhere offers a beautiful teacup and saucer for under $5. Much of what we do in a creative recovery may seem silly. Silly's a defense our wet blanket adult uses to squelch our artist child. Creativity lives in paradox. Serious art is born from serious play. Let's take a look at counting. This is an exercise in choice making. By using it, you will make choices that support your artist. For the next week, you'll be discovering how you spend your money. You'll need to buy a small pocket notepad and write down everything you spend. You may want to continue this practice for a full month or longer. It will teach you what you value in terms of your spending. Often, our spending differs from our real values. For many of us, counting is a necessary prelude to learning creative luxury. Let's take a look at what I call money madness. This is just a quick exercise where you complete or free associate on the following phrases. People with money are... Money makes people... I'd have more money if... My dad thought money was... My mom always thought money would... In my family, money caused... Money equals... I'm afraid that if I had money, I would... Money causes. In order to have more money, I'd need to. When I have money, I usually. I think money. If I weren't so cheap, I'd. Being broke tells me. Loaded questions, but interesting. That's it for week 6. Let's take a look at our tasks. Number 1, natural abundance. Find 5 pretty or interesting rocks. Number 2, natural abundance. Pick 5 flowers or leaves. Number 3, creation. Bake something. If you have a sugar problem, make a fruit salad. Creativity does not always have to involve capital A art. Number 4, communication. Send postcards to 5 friends. Number 5, prosperity. Any changes in your financial situation or your perspective on it? Any new, even crazy ideas about what you would love doing? Pull images around these. Add them to your image file. Work on images of abundance. Week 7, recovering a sense of connection. Art is not about thinking something up. It's about the opposite, getting something down. The directions are important here. If we're trying to think something up, we are straining to reach for something that's beyond our grasp. When we get something down, there is no strain. We're not doing, we're getting. Instead of reaching for inventions, we are engaged in listening. Art is an act of tuning in and dropping down the well. It's as though all the stories, painting, music, performances in the world live just under the surface of our normal consciousness. We tap into them by listening. All of us have had moments when we could hear quite clearly, when we felt we were simply taking dictation. These moments of clear inspiration require that we move into them on faith, We can practice these small leaps of faith daily in our pages and on our artist dates. We can learn not only to listen, but also to hear with increasing accuracy that inspired, intuitive voice that says, "Do this, try this, say this." Some people find it easier to picture the stream of inspiration as being like radio waves of all sorts being broadcast at all times. With practice, we learn how to hear the desired frequency on request. Once you accept the idea that it is natural to create, you can begin to accept a second idea, that the Creator will hand you whatever you need for a project. You will hear the dialogue you need, find the right song for the sequence, see the exact paint color you almost had in mind, and so forth. Learn to accept the possibility that the universe is helping you with what you're doing. Try to remember that God is the great artist and that artists like other artists. Expect the universe to support your dream. It will. No matter how much universal support we get, we can still block it if we indulge in a faux called perfectionism. Tilly Olson correctly calls it the knife of the perfectionist attitude in art. You may call it something else. Getting it right, you may call it. Or fixing it before I go any further. You may call it having standards. What you should be calling it is perfectionism. Perfectionism has nothing to do with getting it right. It has nothing to do with fixing things. Perfectionism is a refusal to let yourself move ahead. It's a loop, an obsessive, debilitating, closed system that causes you to get stuck in the details of what you're writing or painting or making and to lose sight of the whole. Instead of creating freely and allowing errors to reveal themselves later as insights, we often get mired in getting the details right the first time. Fearing mistakes, we correct our originality into a uniformity that lacks passion and spontaneity. "Do not fear mistakes," Miles Davis told us. "There are none." But for the perfectionist, there are no first drafts, rough sketches, warm-up exercises. For the perfectionist, every draft is meant to be final. See if you recognize this behavior. Midway through a project, the perfectionist decides to read it all over, outline it again, see exactly where it's going. In other words, abort the completion. The perfectionist is never satisfied. The perfectionist never says, "This is pretty good. I think I'll just keep going." Perfectionism is not a quest for the best. It is a pursuit of the worst in ourselves, the part that tells us that nothing we ever do will be good enough, that we should try again. Perfectionism is pulling up your art by the roots before it has time to grow. This brings us to taking risks. Here's a question. What would I do if I didn't have to do it perfectly? Here's the answer. A great deal more than I'm doing now. We've all heard that the unexamined life is not worth living, but consider, too, that the unlived life is not worth examining. The success of a creative recovery hinges on our ability to move out of the head and into a body of action. "I'll look like an idiot," we say, conjuring images of our first acting class, our first hobbled short story, our terrible drawings. We deny that in order to do something well, we must first be willing to do it badly. Instead, we opt for setting our limits at the point where we feel assured of success. Working artists know the folly of this stance. There's a common joke among directors, "Oh yeah, I always know exactly how I should direct a picture, after I'm done directing it." As artists, once we begin to accept that anything worth doing might even be worth doing badly, our options widen. Our world becomes larger. We are able to move into risk. Ask yourself, if I didn't have to do it perfectly, what would I try? The answers might be, stand-up comedy, archery, learning German, figure drawing, figure skating, being a platinum blonde, the trapeze. Very often, a risk is worth taking simply for the sake of taking it. Now, complete the following sentence in your head or on a sheet of paper. Do it 5 times. If I didn't have to do it perfectly, I'd try. If I didn't have to do it perfectly, I'd try. If I didn't have to do it perfectly, I'd try. If I didn't have to do it perfectly, I'd try. If I didn't have to do it perfectly, I'd try. It gets very interesting. We're going to look at a tool now that tells us some of the things we would like to try if we didn't have to do them perfectly. This means we're going to look at jealousy, the emotion that points the way. Jealousy, I've often heard, is a normal human emotion. When I hear that, I think, well, maybe your jealousy, not mine. Only recently have I seen it for the tough love friend that it is. Jealousy is a map. It tells you the territory that you covet. Each of our jealousy maps differ. Each of us will probably be surprised by some of the things we discover on our own. I, for example, have never been eaten alive with resentment over the success of women novelists. But I took an unhealthy interest in the fortunes and misfortunes of women playwrights. I was a very harsh critic until I wrote my first play. With that action, my jealousy vanished, replaced by a feeling of camaraderie. My jealousy had actually been a mask for my fear of doing something I wanted. Jealousy's always a mask for fear. Fear that we aren't able to get what we want, frustration that somebody else seems to be getting what's rightfully ours, even if we're too frightened to reach for it. At its root, jealousy is a stingy emotion. It doesn't allow for the abundance and multiplicity of the universe. Jealousy tells us there's only room for one poet, one painter, one whatever you dream of being. The people on your jealousy map occupy the position you'd like to fill yourself. Now the truth, revealed by action in the direction of our dreams, is that there is room for all of us. Now let's take a look at the jealousy map. It's an exercise that will move you into the territory that you desire. Your jealousy map will be done in 3 stages. Stage 1, name those you're jealous of. You might call it being envious, you might call it being resentful. Try to come up with 10 or 20 names. Stage 2, next to each one of those names, write exactly why you're jealous. Let's take Jessica Lange. Are you jealous of her because she's a marvelous actress? Because she lives with Sam Shepard? Either or both? I take my sister Libby. I'm often jealous of Libby. Sometimes it's because she has a new studio. Sometimes it's because she lets herself ride every single day. The point is to indicate precisely what you're really jealous of. Now you're ready to move on to stage 3. Again, look at the name of the person you're jealous of. Look at the reason you're jealous of that person. And now think of an action which you can take which will move you in the same direction. For example, if you're jealous of Glenn because he's tall and he's fit, you can't make yourself any taller, but you could exercise daily. That would be an action antidote for your jealousy. Do this with every name on your list. Remember, green is the color of jealousy, but it's also the color of hope. Some of us find looking at our jealousies just a little bit rough, so it's important that we pause at this point to acknowledge our positive inventory. Finish these phrases either on paper or just in your head. Count coup, as Native Americans say. count your blessings. I have a loyal friend in. Writing my morning pages has shown me that I can. My artist has started to pay more attention to. I'm taking a greater interest in. Possibly my creativity is. And possibly it is. Just to help it along a little bit more, let's do an exercise called archaeology. Not only will your answers tell you what you missed in the past, they will tell you more about what you can be doing now to comfort and encourage your artist child. Complete these phrases, either on paper or in your head. As a kid, I missed the chance to. As a kid, I could have used. As a kid, I dreamed of being. As a kid, I needed more. For years, I've missed and wondered about. Be gentle with yourself. Many times the associations that spring to mind from archaeology are lost pieces of yourself. At first, they can feel as jagged as glass. Later, you'll find them to be part of the mosaic that you are building. That's week 7. Now let's take a look at our tasks. Number 1. Make this phrase a mantra. Treating myself like a precious object will make me strong. Number 2. Give yourself time out to listen to 20 minutes of music just for joy. Number 3. Take yourself into a sacred space, a church, synagogue, library, grove of trees, and allow yourself to savor the silence and the healing solitude. Number 4. Buy yourself one wonderful pair of socks, one wonderfully comforting, self-loving something. Number 5. Collage. Collect a stack of at least 10 magazines. Set a 20-minute time limit for yourself. Tear through the magazines, collecting any image that reflects your life or your interests. Now, take a sheet of newspaper, a stapler, some tape or glue, and arrange your images in a way that pleases you. That's it. Number 6. Quickly list 5 favorite films. Do you see any common denominators among them? Are they romances, adventures, period pieces, political dramas, family epics, thrillers? Do you see traces of your cinematic themes in your collage? Don't be surprised if you do. Remember, origin is the root word of original, and you are the origin of your work. Week 8. Recovering a sense of strength. We're going to talk a minute about survival. One of the most difficult tasks an artist must face is that primal one, artistic survival. All artists must learn the art of surviving loss, loss of hope, loss of face, loss of money, loss of self-belief. Because in addition to our many gains, we inevitably suffer these losses in an artistic career. Artistic losses can be turned into artistic gains and strengths, but not in the isolation of our beleaguered artist's brain. In order to move through loss and beyond it, we must acknowledge it, and we must share it. Because artistic losses are seldom openly acknowledged or mourned, they become artistic scar tissue instead. Think of it this way. If artistic creations are our brain children, artistic losses are our miscarriages. At these times, it is important to remember that our artist self is a child, and that what we can handle intellectually far outstrips what we can handle emotionally. We must be alert in order to flag and mourn our losses. In a very real sense, artist abuse is child abuse. For example, a trusting student hears from an unscrupulous teacher that good work is bad, or lacks promise, or that he, the guru, teacher, senses a limit to the student's real talent, or was mistaken in seeing talent, or doubts that there is talent. With comments like these, the student emerges shamed, feeling like a bad artist, or even worse, like a fool to try being an artist. It is my experience that many academics, for example, are themselves artistic beings who are deeply frustrated by their inability to create, skilled in intellectual discourse, distanced by that intellectual skill from their own creative urgings. They often find the creativity of their charges deeply disturbing. Creativity cannot be comfortably quantified in intellectual terms. By its very nature, creativity eschews such containment. In a university where the intellectual life is built upon the art of criticizing, on deconstructing a creative work, the art of creation itself, the art of creative construction, often meets with scanty support, little understanding, scant approval. To be blunt, most academics know how to take something apart, but not how to assemble it. It's not my argument that the world of academia be turned into an exalted artist's studio. It is, however, my point that artists attempting to exist, grow, and even flourish within that milieu must recognize that the entire thrust of intellectualism runs counter to the creative impulse. For an artist, to become overly cerebral is to become crippled. This is not to say that artists lack rigor. Rather, that artistic rigor is grounded differently than intellectual life usually admits. Artists and intellectuals are not the same animal. Younger artists are seedlings. Their early work resembles thicket and underbrush, even weeds. The halls of academia, with their preference for lofty intellectual theorems, do little to support the life of the forest floor. Seeking to prematurely criticize a budding piece of art, they may accidentally uproot it altogether. It would be my hope that the academics listening gain an altered appreciation for the authenticity of growth for the sake of growth. In other words, as taller trees, let us not allow our darker critical powers unfettered play upon the seedling artists in our midst. This is not to say that there is no place for criticism or no room for standards. It is simply a matter of timing and tone, and all too often, our timing is premature and our tone too harsh. Without specific tools and sufficient ego strengths, many gifted young artists suffer for years in the wake of such blows. Of course, it would be lovely if we could avoid such blows altogether, but that's simply not realistic. No inventory of our artistic injuries would be complete without acknowledging that some of our wounds are self-inflicted. Many times as artists, we are offered a chance that we balk at. We sabotage ourselves by our fear, our low self-worth, or simply our other agendas. These lost chances often haunt us bitterly in later years, but for right now, just counting them as losses begins the process of healing. Now let's take a look at gain disguised as loss. Art is the act of structuring time. This is particularly true when we're dealing with an artistic loss. Every loss must always be viewed as a potential gain. It's all in the framing. Every end is a beginning. We need to focus on what lies ahead. This can be tricky. Gain disguised as loss is a potent artist's tool. To acquire it, simply, brutally ask, how can this loss serve me? Where does it point my work? The answers will surprise and liberate you. The trick is to metabolize pain as energy. Learn, when hit by loss, to ask the right question. What next? Instead of, why me? Whenever I am willing to ask, what is necessary next, I've moved ahead. Whenever I take no for a final answer, I've stalled and gotten stuck. I have learned that the key to career resiliency is self-empowerment and choice. Non illegitimi te carborundum, the Graffitian prisoner of war camps is said to have run. The rough translation, which is very important for artists, is, don't let the bastards get you down. Question. Do you know how old I'll be by the time I learn to play the piano? Answer. The same age you'll be if you don't. Many blocked creatives tell themselves they're both too old and too young to allow themselves to pursue their dreams. As blocked creatives, we like to pretend that a year or even several years is a long, long time. But our ego plays this little trick just to keep us from getting started. At the heart of the anorexia of artistic avoidance is the denial of process. We like to focus on having learned a skill or having made an artwork. This attention to final form ignores the fact that creativity lies not in the done, but in the doing. I'm writing a screenplay is infinitely more interesting to the soul than I have written a screenplay. Focused on process, our creative life retains a sense of adventure. Focused on product, the same creative life can feel foolish or barren. We inherit the obsession with product and the idea that art produces finished product from our consumer-oriented society. This focus creates a great deal of creative block. We, as active artists, may want to explore a new artistic area, but we don't see where it will get us. We wonder if it'll be good for our careers. Fixated on the need to have something to show for our labors, we often deny our curiosity. Denying our curiosity, we deny our growth. Every time we do this, we're blocked. So, the grace to be a beginner is always the best prayer for an artist. The beginner's humility and openness lead to exploration. Exploration leads to accomplishment. But all of it begins at the beginning, with that first small and scary step. Speaking of small and scary steps, with the emphasis on the small, let's take a look now at filling the form. What do I mean by filling the form? I mean taking the next small step instead of skipping ahead to a large one for which you may not be prepared. Most of the time, the next right thing is something small. Doing the daily pages, washing out your paintbrushes, stopping by the art supply store and getting your clay. All too often, when people look to have a more creative life, they hold an unspoken and often unacknowledged expectation or fear that they will be abandoning life as they know it. I can't be a writer and stay in this marriage, they think. I can't pursue my painting and stay at this dull job. I can't commit to acting and stay in Chicago. Blocked creatives like to think they are looking at changing their whole life in one fell swoop. This form of grandiosity is very often its own undoing. By setting the jumps too high and making the price tag too great, the recovering artist sets defeat in motion. Creative people are dramatic, and we use negative drama to scare ourselves out of our creativity. Indulging ourselves in a frantic fantasy of what our life would look like if we were real artists, we fail to see the many small creative changes that we could make at this very moment. This kind of look at the big picture thinking ignores the fact that a creative life is grounded on many, many small steps and on very few large ones. Rather than take a scary baby step toward our dreams, we rush to the edge of the cliff and stand there quaking, saying, I can't leap, I can't, I can't. One of our favorite things to do instead of our art is to contemplate the odds. Now, in a creative career, thinking about the odds is a drink of emotional poison. It robs us of the dignity of art as process, and it puts us at the mercy of imagined powers out there.